Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the cave-in to North Korean terrorist threats invoking 9/11 by America's largest movie theater companies, who are refusing to show the Seth Rogen, James Franco comedy, The Interview, due out at Christmas. Sun Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University, joins us to discuss the disgraceful abdication of freedom of speech and capitulation by American corporations to ludicrous and empty threats from a criminal regime with almost no presence or supporters in the United States. While beyond rhetoric, according to the Department of Homeland Security, there is, quote, no credible intelligence to indicate an active plot. Then we'll examine the historic shift in U.S. foreign policy announced today by President Obama, heralding a new chapter in U.S.-Cuban policy following a 45-minute phone call on Monday with Cuba's President Raul Castro and active intervention by the Pope to bring about a prisoner swap that opened the door for the breakthrough to end a dysfunctional, almost 70-year-long frozen relationship. Arturo Lopez Levy, who worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government and is now a consultant to the New American Foundation and the Inter-American Dialogue about Cuba and American policy towards Latin America, joins us to discuss the beginning of normalization between the United States and Cuba. Then finally, we'll look into what a renewal of relations with Cuba might mean, particularly in terms of U.S. investments in Cuba and whether this will improve the lives of Cubans or increase the wealth of multinational companies building megaports and tourist hotels. Luis Martinez Fernandez, a professor of history at the University of Central Florida who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic, joins us to discuss his concerns that Cuba could be recolonized and his new book, Revolutionary Cuba, a History. And joining us now is Sun Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korean Institute of Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sun Yoon Lee.
Much for having me on.
And my sense is, as I mentioned in the opening here, that I'm just absolutely shocked and dismayed at corporate America, or at least the major cinema owners in this country, for absolutely having no regard for freedom of speech, abdicating any sense of you know, responsibility, and capitulating unnecessarily to these ludicrous and empty threats from North Korea. And North Korea doesn't have any real presence here, and certainly don't have many supporters in the United States. And the Department of Homeland Security saying there is no credible intelligence to indicate an active plot. So, what's your understanding of why American corporations are caving in?
I think capitulation is right. It's really hard for me to imagine the rationale behind the decision by Sony to withdraw or to change its decision to release the film on the 25th, because North Korea really, as you say, has no physical presence in the United States. There are no North Korean criminal cells, terrorist cells, if you will, that may carry out any attacks against U.S. corporations or the public at large. North Korea is, by the way, halfway around the world. We know North Korea has periodically launched lethal attacks against South Korea, but South Korea is North Korea's neighbor. The U.S. is far away, and perhaps most importantly, North Koreans are bizarre and they say outrageous things, but they are not suicidal. They are not jihadists, if you will. North Korea is highly unlikely to try to bomb a U.S. theater out in L.A. or on the East Coast, even if it had that capability, which is quite suspect. So unless the decision makers were paranoid about, I don't know, the unlikely prospect of a lone wolf or some misguided person thinking he's carrying out the righteous deed on behalf of North Korea and going on a rampage at a theater at the opening, or something like that, it's really hard for me to imagine the rationale behind this decision.
So why does our press and Sony and these theater owners, why do they continually suggest that this is not a North Korean cyber attack, and that as though there's another possibility out there? There have been some suggestions of it being an inside job at Sony. I mean, the record is so clear that North Korea has done this before to South Korean corporations and media companies. And by the way, it wasn't just an intrusion into Sony's computers. They actually, there was a terabytes worth of information that were extracted, and they scrubbed, they wiped the entire database. This was a destructive attack. This wasn't espionage. And it was carried out in a very sophisticated way, and it has endless North Korean fingerprints on it. So why this equivocation over here in the United States about who is behind this?
Well, the U.S. government has just come out a couple of hours ago, I think, and has pointed the finger finally at North Korea. It had North Korean fingerprints all over it. We know North Korea has a very advanced cyber warfare unit and capabilities. And as you say, North Korea has been implicated beyond reasonable doubt in numerous attacks on South Korean banks and government agencies and so forth in the past. And North Korea has been the only country that has come out and openly threatened Sony and the United States for its plan to release the film in December. And North Korea came out just about 10 days ago on December 7th and said that it supports this, quote, righteous deed of the supporters and sympathizers of North Korea, referring to this massive cyber attack on Sony. So, yes, it was evident, or it was highly likely that it was North Korea from the very beginning. And finally, the U.S. government has come out and pointed a finger at North Korea.
Again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Now, the whole point of the First Amendment is that you protect all speech, even unpopular and perhaps unpleasant speech. And nobody is saying that this movie, The Interpreter, which is about killing a head of state, is necessarily a good idea. And certainly if, say, the Russians or the Iranians made a film, the climax of which is the head of an American president exploding, we might find that uncomfortable. But
we would not threaten to bomb that country. We would not, on a government level, hack into the film industry or the company that made that film. You know, we would air our disapproval, our views, our anger in a civilized way. But, you know, North Korea has acted like a terrorist organization, a criminal syndicate for many, many years, dozens of years, maybe four decades or so. North Korea is really the only country in the world that produces and sells illicit drugs like heroin, meth, and so forth, that counterfeits U.S. currency, that produces and sells fake, famous U.S. brand cigarettes. So for North Korea to do this is no surprise, yes. But for the United States, for a major American corporation and American companies to cave in like this to terrorist cyber threat, and to cave in, I think sets a very unfortunate precedent. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression, of course. That's a universal human right, the freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek and receive, impart information and any ideas. And that way of life has been jeopardized by this capitulation, self-induced capitulation.
And again, the American companies involved, the major theater chains are Regal Entertainment, AMC Entertainment, Cinemark, and the Cineplex Entertainment, Landmark Sunshine Cinemas, and Bowtie Cinemas, and ArcLight Cinemas, and Carmike Cinemas. And that's the part that I find incomprehensible, that they should cave in and capitulate to these outrageous threats to invoking 9/11 when this country doesn't have the capability to do it, but they are making these threats. And the idea that that American corporations obviously don't care about freedom of speech. They don't think that that's an issue that's worth taking a stand on. Pardon?
Yeah. They're practicing self-censorship on an empty threat, on bluster alone. And, you know, on the crudometer, the standard of crudeness and crassness, there's no need to descend to North Korea's level. But let me just say, this year alone, the North Korean government, not some Hollywood film company or the equivalent in North Korea, if there is any like that, the North Korean government has called President Obama, and I quote, wicked black monkey. The North Korean government has called the South Korean president, who is a woman, a dirty old whore. The North Korean government has school children do physical exercise by thrusting wooden bayonets at effigies and pictures of President Obama and the South Korean president. So, yes, we don't engage in, you know, crass and really just barbarous behavior like that on a governmental level. But I think in America, the freedom to make movies as one wishes, to express views, no matter how crude they may be, that freedom should certainly be protected.
Well, it is extremely disappointing and quite disgusting that these companies have rolled over the way that they have preemptively and not make it a stand. But be that as may, what I find extraordinary is that there's this reluctance for the press in this country to call it like it is. I mean, this, just to give you an idea of why, obviously this is the North Korean regime and why they are so upset about this film, is this is a quote from, official quote from the North Korean ministry. The U.S. has gone reckless in such provocative hysteria as bribing a rogue movie maker to dare hurt the dignity of the supreme leadership of the DPRK. It's absolutely intolerable if the distribution of such a film in the U.S., as it is the most undisguised terrorism and a war action, to deprive the service personnel and people of the DPRK of their mental mainstay and bring down its social system. So there's the government itself basically saying that our leader is our mental mainstay. You know, this is it, the ultimate in brainwashing.
Well, one fundamental definition of international terrorism is not only blowing up big buildings and engaging in massacres of civilians, but coercing and intimidating, threatening a civilian population for political ends. And, you know, that definition fits right here. North Korea has effectively, very cheaply, and without much effort, threatened the United States' major American corporations to heed North Korea's threats and to exercise self-censorship. It's really a sad day in the history of American democracy.
But it's clear that what the motives are, that they have created a system here in North Korea, which I think we erroneously refer to as a communist regime, when it more resembles Imperial Japan in the 1930s in terms of emperor worship, and that this family, the Kim family, who have turned themselves into a dynasty and also deified themselves, that this is why they're fighting tooth and nail against this movie, because it attacks the mental mainstay, quoting the government itself.
Yes, indeed. North Korea, the leadership, the cultish leadership, is a hodgepodge. It's an amalgamation of Japan's cult worship, the taboos attached to the emperor in the 1930s and 40s, Stalinism, communism, ancient Korean monarchy, and so forth. And yes, the leader is treated as a semi-god in North Korea, so they clearly don't like this kind of movie. That's right. But, again, North Korea is not crazy. North Korea is not suicidal. Even had the movie been shown, premiered as scheduled, it's really, really unlikely. I mean, you know, it's inconceivable that North Korea would have tried to launch an attack against American theaters, even if they had that capability, which they don't. So really, there was no pragmatic reason to cave in like this. And, you know, a dangerous precedent has been set for would-be copycats and would-be terrorists.
Well, it Sony's basically, I think, it's mainly culpable for being incompetent in terms of protecting its own internet from intrusion. Now, apparently, because this is a North Korean military operation, there's a huge gulf. I talked recently with a computer expert who works in cyber warfare and counter warfare, if that's the right term, and he was telling me that. The militaries, the Chinese, the Russians, the U.S., and to a lesser extent the North Koreans, are way ahead of the civilians in terms of both launching and defending against cyber attacks. And so given that caveat that the corporations are way behind the military in terms of protecting their data, this apparently is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, commercial hack in history. So a lot of damage has been done, and I imagine these American corporations, these theater companies, are afraid that their data is going to be attacked. But why they're not defending their own? I mean, the responsibility is theirs to defend their own data. And I don't know. I guess is there any politician in this country who's going to stand up and condemn these corporations for their craven behavior?
Well, President Obama, or at least the Secretary of State, should publicly denounce North Korea and, I guess, obliquely also criticize the decisions by American companies at exercising self-censorship. Well, that's really what you suggest, that Sony lacks the capability to defend itself against future cyber attacks by North Korea and others. That's really the only rational justification or reason that I can think of behind this decision to listen to North Korea's threats, that they have doubt, that these companies have doubt, fear a future North Korean cyber attacks and are unable to defend themselves. So it's self-serving more than, in my estimation, the decision is probably more self-serving than purely in the interest of public safety.
Well, it is, as you say, a sad day for freedom of speech and a disgraceful abdication on the part of these companies to basically cave into this bluster. We're always told, you know, you don't pay ransom, you don't give in to terrorists, and here we have corporate America doing exactly that. I thank you for joining us, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with the historical shift in U.S. policy towards Cuba. And joining us now is Arturo López-Levy, a lecturer and PhD candidate at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He is a consultant to the New America Foundation and the Inter-American Dialogue about Cuba and American policy towards Latin America. In Cuba, before his emigration to the United States in 2001, López-Levy worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arturo López-Levy.
It's a great pleasure to be in the program, Ian.
Well, thank you, Arturo. And what do you make of today's announcement by President Obama of the beginnings of normalization with Cuba after almost 70 years of a dysfunctional relationship? Apparently, he spoke with President Raul Castro on Monday, and apparently also the Pope intervened to make this prisoner swap work, which obviously paved the way for this breakthrough. What's your response, having worked for the Cuban government and now in the United States?
Well, I think that this is a historical landmark that basically correct the big mistake that was the rupture of relationship in 1961, in January of 1961. Here, the president basically is aligning American policies towards Cuba to American democratic values and international law. From the point of view of Cuba, this is quite important because it gives momentum to the processes of economic reform, political liberalization, and openness to the outside world that is taking place under the leadership of Raul Castro. For the United States, is key to have the right perception about what Cuba is. President Obama basically is beginning a process to change the official perception about Cuba in the United States from a threat to American national security, from a threat to U.S. strategic interests, to more a country in transition for which a policy of engagement and contact is more useful.
And do you think that this deal could have been made with Fidel Castro?
You know, the problem is that the name Fidel Castro invoked a lot of hostility in significant segments of the American public. But something that is clear is that this is the first step to a post-Castro Cuba, and also the first step to recognize that the Cold War is over. This is very strategic also for U.S. Latin American relationship in the horizon of the Summit of the Americas that will take place in Panama in April. This is quite important because the U.S. policy towards Cuba was seen as a test case for the new multilateral approach that President Obama, Secretary Kerry, and Secretary Kerry proclaim in their trips to the region and also in the Organization of American States that is in a very bad shape. So it's a very clever move. It's not something that the president has done out of the blue. There has been polls in the Cuban-American community and in the American public in general that reflect a desire to move over, to move on from the policies of the Cold War and to establish a different approach, more engagement approach towards the changes that are taking place in the island.
And Arturo López-Levy, the fact that the president is just about to sign sanctions against Venezuela, and Venezuela is, of course, an important source of energy for Cuba, is there any connection there in the sense that do you think the Cuban government are concerned that their oil subsidies from Venezuela may dry up? What do you think pushed Raul Castro into this deal?
You know, if you read a book, there is a book that was published recently that is called Back Channels to Cuba, that was published by was written by William Liogrand and Peter Kornbluk. You will see that even Fidel Castro was also always interested in some kind of accommodation with the United States. So it's not a surprise that Raul Castro would have take this the possibility of this deal. this is something that the Cuban nationalist has been struggling for decades. It's the idea of establishing, restoring the relationship with the United States without kowtowing to the demands of the Helms-Burton Law. I think that the first priority of Cuban diplomacy today is to build a friendlier world to the reforms that are taking place. Obviously, this outside world is becoming more friendly if you count the move by the Brazilian, the move by the Europeans that are restoring a dialogue and negotiating an agreement, a general agreement of cooperation with Cuba, the role of Russia, China, etc. But the jewel in the crown would be a restoration of relationship with the United States and eventually an opening of relationship with the American society that include business, educational institutions, cultural institutions, religious groups. It's basically something that open a lot of doors in Cuba domestic politics. And obviously, Raúl Castro will claim a lot of merits, and this will bolster his situation within the nationalist camp in Cuba. Something that is very important to understand is that the Cuban Revolution is at the same time a communist revolution, but most of its reservoir of legitimacy is in Cuban nationalism.
Again, I'm speaking with Arturo López-Levy, a lecturer and PhD candidate at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the consultant to the New America Foundation and the Inter-American Dialogue about Cuba and American policy towards Latin America. In Cuba, before his emigration to the United States in 2001, López-Levy worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government. So in terms of Cuban nationalism, what would the Cuban nationalists want to preserve in terms of, because it would seem to me that waiting in the wings here are a lot of American corporations. You know, Cuba has pristine beaches, empty beaches for miles and miles, empty preserved pristine forests. Is it going to become a mecca for, and there's of course this very ambitious big port that's being built to sort of make, I guess, it's at Mariel, I think, the kind of Singapore of the Caribbean. So what will be the nature of this relationship in terms of how Cuban society changes? Will this raise the standard of living for Cuban people, or will it make multinational corporations richer?
Well, you know, this is a challenge for the Cuban government and the Cuban society to manage. First, the embargo is not ended. There is Raúl Castro spoke today to the Cuban people, and one of the first things that he said is, this is not the end of the hostile policy by the United States against the Cuban people. And basically, he mentioned the permanence of the basis for the embargo as a law approved by Congress, the so-called Helms-Burton, that was sponsored by Jesse Helms and members of a whites-only club and so on, that people in Latin America and in Africa also don't respect at all his credential as someone in favor of democracy or something like that. But there is a long road to walk between the two countries. There is the issue of the U.S. Naval base in Guantanamo. But the most important thing I will call your attention is that the image of Cuba as a threat to the United States, either at the Caribbean or at the world level, has been replaced by the image of a Cuba in transition. And obviously, now Cuba would have to know better the United States. There will be opportunities for legitimate business with American small, medium, and large corporations. But also, obviously, there are elements there that need to be negotiated. To be clear with you, I think that the American business community compared with the type of investment that Cuba is getting in the island, is better regulated in certain areas that business from China or from emerging markets such as Angola, Malaysia, etc. Because we have the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act that basically allowed non-governmental organizations, even different entities, to prosecute in American courts cases of bribe and corruption towards Cuban officials. And this is obviously the issue of corruption is a big danger for the transition to a mixed economy that is taking place in the island.
So in terms of what the Pope brought about, or at least was actively involved in urging and facilitating, and that is the prisoner swap, the so-called Cuban Five were swapped, and some people refer to them as spies, other people refer to them as Cubans who had come here to investigate the hostile acts of the Cuban-American community in Miami. But I'm not sure the details of, supposedly they went to the FBI with this information and were arrested. But on the other hand, I don't know how they got into the country. So that, you know, whatever they were in terms of an espionage swap, what we don't know much about is the American who's been held there for decades. Do you know anything about him?
No, there was no American that was held there for decades. There was a Cuban agent who was working for the U.S. Intelligence community.
Uh-huh.
And this is very important, Ian, to clarify. There was no swap of the Cuban spies in the United States for Mr. Gross. Raul Castro has said before that Mr. Gross was not a spy, but he was part of the regime change programs implemented by the USAID, because unfortunately the USAID, that is a great agency promoting development and cooperation like sanitation in other countries, in the case of Cuba, has been transformed by the Helms-Burton law into an agency for regime change imposed from abroad. So the Cuban government reacted, responded to these programs by incarcerating Alan Gross, who was an active participant on that. But the exchange, the swap of spies, was done not with Alan Gross, was done with a Cuban who was working for U.S. intelligence agencies, and as a humanitarian gesture, in parallel, acknowledged by the White House, Cuba released Alan Gross and some other prisoners that President Obama expressed interest on them. And this is quite important, because there is no precedent of exchanging an American, regardless of his involvement in programs that are in conflict with international law, by the Cuban spies. There was a spy for a spy, and in addition to that, the White House took notice that Cuba was releasing several prisoners as a humanitarian gesture, particularly the case of Alan Gross, someone that different segments of the American public opinion, particularly the Jewish community, more than 500 rabbis, has written a letter to President Obama asking him to take responsibility for the situation with Alan Gross.
So, Arturo López-Levy, you had an article recently in the Huffington Post, Hypocrisy and the Right to Travel to Cuba. And
yeah,
this pointed out, you made the point that the staffers for Senator Rubio and Congresswoman Roz Layton took a trip to China where they were paid for by the Chinese government on a political junket. And, of course, the bosses have been so outspoken in and have pushed through legislation restricting travel to Cuba and suggesting that anybody going to communist Cuba is a traitor. And at the same time, their own staffs go to communist China. And there's always been that ridiculous hypocrisy in terms of the label communist. I mean, I don't know whether you can actually even call China communist today. So what's going to happen with people like Senator Rubio and Senator Menendez, both of whom have come out and condemned this deal? Do you think if change has to happen in the Congress to overturn Helms-Burton. What's your reading of the votes there? My sense is that there's a growing constituency in the United States and even in the Republican Party to get past this dysfunctional relationship with Cuba, to increase trade. I believe a lot of the red rural states, their senators, want to trade with Cuba and sell agricultural products. So what's your reading on the blowback from the Cuban-American community?
Well, these people has been obstructing any possibility of improving relationship between Cuba and the United States for decades. But what has happened is that the president has circumvented the role of these petty politicians and basically took into account the fact that recent polls show that the majority, up to 62% of the Cuban-American community, is in favor of a change of policy towards Cuba. In addition to that, after President Obama opened family travel to Cuba, Cuban-Americans were allowed to travel to Cuba to see their relatives and to visit their country of origin. Almost 400,000 Cuban-Americans has traveled to Cuba, while at the same time, their representatives in Congress were advocating for the travel prohibition. This is something that still is in place. Senator Rubio, for instance, just recently or some hours ago, came in opposition to President Obama, and he said that he will do everything possible to block President Obama's move towards Cuba. Senator Rubio has said that he's studying the possibility of running for president, but he's not the president yet, and many of us believe that he will never be, and even if he is, it will be a disgrace for the United States. America has one president at a time, and the president, the last time I checked, the president of the United States is Barack Obama, and he's still very relevant in terms of the foreign policy of this country because he has all the authorities given to him by the Article 2 of our Constitution.
Well, Arturo López-Levy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It has been a great pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who is a lecturer and PhD candidate at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's a consultant to the New America Foundation and the Inter-American Dialogue about Cuba and American policy towards Latin America. In Cuba, before emigrating to the United States in 2001, López-Levy worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether the breakthrough with Cuba will improve the lives of the Cubans or increase the wealth of multinational companies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Luis Martinez Fernandez, who is a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He is a historian of Latin America and the Caribbean, who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and is the author of the new book just out, Revolutionary Cuba, A History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luis Martinez Fernandez. And so how does this extraordinary announcement by President Obama that the United States is going to seek normalization of its relationships with the island of Cuba? This has been the most contentious relationship gone on for decades. And on the Cuban side, apparently the Cuban leader, Raul Castro, has also address the nation and frame this in an historical context. So I guess the question to an historian, is history being made today?
Definitely. I've studied the Cuban Revolution for many years. I wrote a book on it, and I'm thinking back, and I can't think of any event of the magnitude, even the collapse of the Soviet Union, in terms of what this may bring. Cuba and the United States are neighbors. That can't be erased. It's a geographical reality. And what we're beginning to see is something that I guess can expand in so many different directions and bring about change to Cuba, not just in terms of trade relations with the U.S., but in so many other regards.
Well, one of the things that's extraordinary about this announcement is that the president thanked the Canadian government, and he also thanked members of Congress, because there were a couple of congressmen, three congresspeople on board the plane that brought back the American, Alan Gross, who was released in exchange for three Cubans who had been jailed in the U.S. for spying, and another U.S. intelligence asset who had been jailed in Cuba, and he'd been there for more than 20 years. He was also released. But the president, in his speech, thanked the Pope. So yeah. Apparently the Pope had a lot to do with this.
Well, these past 2 weeks, as you know, in terms of world news, have been just amazing with developments throughout the world, things that we didn't even imagine. Let me just give you an example of how I was looking at this just 6 months ago when I decided to end my history of the Cuban Revolution with a photograph of Russian Navy vessels in the Bay of Havana, and sort of letting the reader know that, you know, this is something that we need to keep an eye on, an expansionist Russia. And now we are this week, and we learn that the Soviet economy has all but collapsed, and we hear Obama dropping this news. It's just incredible. When it comes to Cuba, you never know.
Well, but on the other hand, it would seem, Luis Martinez Fernandez, that when it comes to Cuba, you do know it's been frozen. I mean, this has been a dysfunctional relationship frozen in time. And the president, in his speech on Wednesday, said neither the American nor Cuban people are well served by a rigid policy that took place before most of us were born. And, of course, he said he's basically heralding in a new chapter. But it has been, I mean, isn't Cuba in many ways a kind of a time warp? If you go there, the cars on the streets are all 1950s American cars.
Yes, that's true. The island has been disconnected from the outside world, particularly from what we call the West, for so long that many of the Western institutions really do not function in Cuba. They don't function well, and I'm thinking about journalism. I'm thinking about universities, for example. But in other regards, and Cuba has been very actively pursuing this for a long time. I had the incredible experience of witnessing or actually listening to some U.S. Capitalists who are certainly multi-billionaires, and this was about a month ago. And they had already made these plans, and it's not just plans. I'm talking about shaking hands with the Castro brothers, Ramon Castro, for example, deals that had been made. And I think that for a long time, progressives in this country, myself included, have been clamoring for this change and this openness. I am a little bit concerned, however, that we may return to the circumstances of 1898, when U.S. capital just poured in and took over all of the industries, basically.
Well, I hope that in this transition, to my mind, some of the most interesting achievements of Cuba have been how they survived the fact when the Russians collapsed, when the Soviets collapsed and the Russians pulled the plug. on the subsidies, in particular oil, how the country adapted to a post-oil economy. I wish we could do that. And I believe I have friends who have visited Cuba recently and said, you know, there's just miles and miles of protected beaches and forests, and it's just pristine. And I have this vision now of American hotels, and the place is going to end up looking like Miami.
Yes, and I'm also concerned about the land in the country. I mean, because the government took over the lands, the government owns the vast majority of the land on the island. And what's going to happen to that? I do have my concerns. But regarding Cuba, it's interesting to look historically how Cuba has always been so dependent on oil. Of course, the U.S. supplied that before the revolution. Then shortly thereafter, the Soviets started pumping subsidized oil into Cuba. Almost overnight, surprisingly, the Soviet Union collapses. And there was Venezuela in the background. So that was sort of the second alternative to Cuba. The situation in Venezuela is very unclear. I don't think that the current government can survive another election. This last time it was very, very close. And, of course, Cubans are very concerned about a change in Venezuela and now what's happening in the Soviet Union. So, interestingly enough, here comes the United States with its possibility of supplying Cuba with oil, which ironically, a year or so ago, we thought that Cuba would be independent in terms of oil, and that never materialized. So all of these factors really play in the background of this reconciliation, which, by the way, I do welcome.
So when you say you welcome this historic moment, and in terms of history, the fact that President Obama on Monday personally spoke with the Cuban leader Raul Castro for more than 45 minutes about normalizing relations between the two countries, that was the first engagement at a presidential level with Cuba since the Cuban Revolution. That's how the door's been closed for so long. So history's already been made. You're saying, Luis, that you welcome this, but of course Senator Marco Rubio has condemned it, and so has Senator Bob Menendez. What's your sense of how much the Miami Cubans, or the so-called Miami Cubans, do they have the ability to frustrate or sabotage this deal?
That's a very good question. I believe that, well, there's a political face, and then there's a reality, what people really think and would like to happen. I am convinced that most Cubans on the island want to change. In Miami, want to change. It's important to keep in mind two things. One, the majority of the Cubans are no longer the so-called historic wave that came to the U.S. in the 60s and early 70s. We're talking about Cubans in Miami who are younger than 45 years old, who are opposed to the embargo, for example. So this is a change that has been coming. On the other hand, I believe that the Cuban power, political power, as a national force, reached its peak in the year 2000. And since then, when we look at what's happening in Florida, we see that the Puerto Rican population, which has continued to arrive in huge numbers, particularly into central Florida, which is leaning Democrat, that population has already neutralized, I think, the predominantly Republican Cuban vote in South Florida. And that's an interesting dynamic. I think that Florida, one more time, may be a deciding country, and I think, at least in the year 2000, that it was Cuban Americans who made the difference. Ironically, they have no power over Cuba, but in a way, they elected the U.S. president, and I think that has come to an end.
So, Luis Martinez Fernandez, in terms of going forward, obviously, the irritants were removed. They were preconditions. The Cuban spies swapped for the American spies. I'm not suggesting that Alan Gross was necessarily a spy, but there was somebody that they had been holding. I think I had heard that they had been holding this person since, they had been holding somebody since the Cuban Revolution. But in any case, they say that this person's been there for decades. So now that that's out of the way and that the president has instructed Secretary of State Kerry to conduct a review of Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terror, and that they'll be taking steps to increase travel, commerce, and the flow of information to and from Cuba. Already, there's a tremendous amount of people go to and fro, in spite of the fact that they go from Miami, which is what we were just talking about. How's this going to translate to you? I mean, one of the scenarios that I read some time back was that there was a fear that if the relations were normalized, that suddenly everybody in Cuba would want to come to the United States and that you'd have a collapse in Cuba. Is there any likelihood of that?
I don't think so, really. If you've been waiting for some movement in a positive direction on the island for 20, 30, 40 years, and finally there's a possibility of things finally getting settled in Cuba in terms of human rights, civil rights, property rights, etc., I think this would be the worst moment for people to want to leave Cuba. By the way, if we look at Cubans who have come to this country in the last 10 years, they are transnational. They're continuously going back to Cuba. They take money with them. They take supplies. They visit several times a year. So I don't see that massive movement out of Cuba, honestly. What I do fear, and I'm glad that this is happening gradually, not abruptly, in a way in which the Cuban government can control this from above, because otherwise the chaos would have meant that Cuba would be, as I said earlier, back to 1898, vulnerable to the onslaught of foreign capital.
So that's the more likely scenario, that foreign capital will flow in, not that the people will flow out, and that is in itself is something that certainly concerns me, that the idea that the character of the country could be lost overnight, not to mention its pristine forests and pristine beaches.
Yes, I've been thinking about that quite a bit since I heard those gentlemen talk about their plans for Cuba. We know that Raul Castro has begun these reforms, but one thing that I've noticed is that the reforms, as they're happening for Cubans, I would call that an economy of kiosks, very small operations, nothing that can allow an individual to become wealthy. And then the other reforms, which have to do with foreign powers, are enclave investments. And so what I see is something very sad for my country, and that is that Cubans are, at the time being, reduced to working in small businesses, very, very tiny. We don't even call them businesses in this country. And at the same time, foreign capital pouring into the tourist sector, pouring into the port construction. That's one of the big projects in Cuba. So it's a great irony. The government that fought so hard for nationalizing the economy now appears to be willing, and I hope they don't, to hand it over to foreign interests.
And this big port that you're talking about is a huge project, right? That's a kind of a mega port that is trying to create a kind of Singapore in the Caribbean.
Well, and even more so, because we're looking at, and as a student of history, there's one constant in the history of the island, and that is its geography hasn't changed. The 90 miles are still there. The proximity. The role that Cuba can play as a base for re-exporting oil and so many other products to the rest of Latin America is just huge. The opportunities for Florida alone are incredible, yes, Cuba can play those roles. But again, if you look at what's happened in Cuba since Raúl Castro began the reforms, there has been no progress. And we're talking now more than 6 years. There has been no progress in the Cuban economy. What will begin to unfold, and of course, Obama has very limited power over what he can do in terms of normalizing relations, and we can talk about that as well. Obama, and I'm going to throw this at you, and this has to do with the other major piece of news that Obama was pushing so actively for the budget. And I would not be surprised if this had not been in the background of the discussions. I think this was part of the deal. And interestingly, change with Cuba is not coming because of the progressive voices that have been clamoring for change. It is happening because of huge corporations in this country that have been pressuring the administration and for a long time. And that's a great irony, I think.
Well, just in closing, Luis Martinez Fernandez, what's your sense then of how much resonance then Bob Menendez and Marco Rubio are going to have? They seem like they're sort of voices that are going to be sort of baying in the wilderness. But I guess we don't have any polling on this. But my sense is that this is probably going to be greeted by the vast majority of Americans as a positive step forward. And I think, people are just fed up with this surreal nature of this ridiculous. I mean, one of the most ridiculous things of all that sort of characterizes this dysfunctional relationship is radio and TV Marti, where the U.S. government spends a fortune on television and radio broadcasts that take place every day in these big studios down in Miami to broadcast to Cuba, and they're all jammed, so nobody hears them. So, but yet we spend all the money and pretend that we're doing something, you know?
Yes, that's very true. I think you're still going to have those voices, but I think, and I actually am convinced, that in spite of the fact that there are more Cubans in the Senate and Congress than ever, the Cuban political power in this country has already become a secondary force. And I think that Obama, and this is something behind the developments, Obama was really, he was ashamed last time in the meeting of the world, of the leaders of the Americas. Cuba was left alone. And I think this will avoid that, because now apparently Cuba will be welcomed by the United States in the meeting that happens in March.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Luis Martinez Fernandez.
Thank you very much.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.